Hey yo, what's up world? This is DJ JS1 of the legendary Rocksteady Crew. And right now, you're listening to The Library with my man, Tim Einenkel, on rapstation.com. Strictly the real hip-hop. Peace.
Million weight, light is capable of painting up a zillion raps, and when I say it, this is what I mean. Audio 2 and the alliance on the scene, and I like to say what's up to my producer, King of Chill. Party people, are you ready? Jam if you will. Never underestimate.
Our guest has been composing, producing, engineering, MCing, and more for quite some time. His credit starts with MC Lights, Light as a Rock, Audio 2's, What More Can I Say, all the way up to working with Farrah Monch and DJ Premier. That said, it's really hard to find detailed information about him because he's regarded as an innovator and one very unappreciated talents. He's King of Chill, and I want to welcome him to the Library with Tim Einenkel. Thanks, man, for joining us.
What's going on? What's happening?
All right, so here's my understanding. You started producing albums in 1988. This is my research on the internet. This is what I got. With Audio 2, Audio 2 is What More Can I Say, and MC Lights, Light as a Rock. But then while researching you, I came across The Beast Within with you and the Alliance.
Right.
And that was 1985. So one, is that correct? But then two, prior to 1988 and 1985, I guess what was happening with you in terms of like music and stuff like that?
Before 1985... you know, I was like every other kid in the neighborhood. Hip hop was taking over, and you know, everybody was forming some sort of crew, and that's basically what I did. I was with a crew in Brooklyn, and we used to practice and rehearse every day in my man's basement. Mike, he was our first DJ. Master Mike was his name, and we would practice every day. This is before 85. This is like 81, 82. And we would just rehearse for no reason. It's not like we had a party to do or we were going to battle somebody. It was just like we just practiced because we wanted to be good, right? You know, good enough so we could go somewhere and say, oh, wow, yo, those guys are dope. Those guys are deaf. And that's what we did. So leading up to 84, 85, 84 is when I first came across a lady that worked at a label called Supertronics. And that was the first label that we ended up putting something out on called The Beast Within. It was about police brutality. And it came out in 85. Brutality is against the law, but that's not according to what I saw. I saw flashing lights, I heard sirens roar.
So when did you, I guess, when did you know, or when did people, I guess, start to talk around you that maybe you guys want to do this for money, or, you know, like, not just to, like, quote unquote, impress people around, but also, like, hey, maybe there's something here. Maybe we could sign with a label or, you know, get a record press professionally.
That was around 84. It was around 84 because even though we didn't do as many parties or as many battles with other crews as we would like to, We found that we were good. We were good enough to put a concept across, like, a, you know, a record, and we decided to do it.
So then how did you get from MCing to producing? And then do you remember that first thing you produced?
Yes, I do. Okay, so what had happened was that back then I was the first to have a quote unquote real job. So coming right out of high school, I worked for the State Department. And so my job, so I was making quote unquote real money at a regular job as opposed to a part-time job or a minimum wage job. So I was the one that brought the equipment. Now, back then, I was an MC, just an MC, and that's all I wanted to do. So I'm like, and all of us are like, me, Swift, and Mike, Master Mike, we're like, all right, I'm an MC, Eric's an MC, and you're the DJ. So as the DJ, you're going to do all the music. We're going to do all the raps. I'm going to write most of the raps, and boom, we're going to rock out like that. Okay, cool. Boom. Fast forward a couple of months later, you know, it felt like the more popular we got, the lazier everybody seemed to get. Like we would like, so I went out and I started buying small things. Like I bought a drum machine. I bought a small sampler. I bought an effect machine, a digital delay, stuff like that, microphones and all of that. And kept all the stuff at the DJ's house because he's the DJ. He's going to learn how to make beats and we're going to rock out and we're going to DJ and da 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 and put on these shows. The equipment started just laying around. Everybody's hanging out with their girl. Nobody's doing nothing. I'm like, yo, this costs a lot of money. It's collecting dust. I got mad one day. I came in, took my equipment back home, and I was mad. And I had to learn it. I was like, yo, this is whack. I had to learn this equipment. I'm not the producer. I don't want to produce. I'm the rapper. So I mean, that's how I got into producing.
So all self-taught. I mean,
yeah, a lot of it was self-taught and a lot of it was, I would call, good mentoring, because what it was without knowing it, I was putting out an energy of what I wanted to do, what my focus was, and who I wanted to be in line with. So what started happening was cats that were on already, cats that were focused and doing what I wanted to do, producers, DJs, MCs, those are the people that started suddenly appearing in my life and kind of mentoring me in little things like teach me what MIDI was and you know, how you go about doing this and how you go about doing that. And all of that helped me to, you know, do what I eventually started doing.
Do you remember the first kind of beat you made where you're like, all right, like this is, I could do this. Like, you know, I imagine I tried to make beats once and I was got awful at it, but,
oh man.
Or even like the first beat that someone, let's say like an MC Light came to you or something, or mm-hmm. Audio 2 that, you know, they came to you and said, we heard this, we want you for us to do, you know?
Yeah, I kind of sort of remember that. It was more of, first of all, you got to know how to hit that delete button. And so I did a lot of experimenting and making beats, and I would hit the delete button before I would let somebody hear something, because I was like, nah, this is whack. A whole lot of critical thinking. And then finally, when I did let somebody hear something, you know, I got more approval than, oh no, nah, that's whack. And that's pretty much how it happened. The first beat, I really don't remember, but I know it involved, one drum machine, one sampler with a very short sample rate. But it didn't involve any samples or loops at the time. And it was just a good idea, the song that we put together and started putting together. It was pretty, you know, we were trying to be Houdini.
So did you just then with that, did you just go away from MCing, or did you try to dip your hand in both?
What ended up happening was I would dip my hand in both, because I ended up being the producer of the track and the, like, the main writer of the concept of the routine. It was less songs back then and more of a routine of a back and forth. And like when we did Bustin' Loose, I can tell that you approve by the top of your feet, by the bopping of your head, moving up your torso. Yo, I'm the king of chillin', you just lost to know. There's no doubt. Bustin' Loose kinda was how we envisioned us doing songs. It was like a back and forth, and everybody was involved in every verse, and the DJ was definitely part of it. I always felt that the DJ needed to be heard on the records just as much as the MC. And, you know, that's how I started formulating the productions of you know, that early stuff. Everybody's jamming, only suckers cold snapping. Do it to simplicity, only done to ecstasy.
fellas want the fresh, while the girlies want the best of me. I don't mean to say that I'm the best or the greatest. Only when we screw up, they come and try to raid it. Alliance in a pack, in the group or solo.
So then how did MC Light and then Audio 2 happen, and kind of what, at that time, who were they to you? I mean, were they like, did you know they were like the next big thing, or were they just like these local cats that were just, you know, rhyming? Who were they to you at the time?
Yeah. They were all local cats. They all owed me money. No, this is how it went down. So in high school, I went to Brooklyn Tech. And in high school, at the lunchroom table, I'm sitting at the lunchroom table, and I'm sitting at this particular table because these cute girls that are in, I forget what class it was, sat at the other end. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to sit here. Boom, this kid comes next to me with these glasses on, and he's sweating the same girls that I'm sweating. His name was Giz.
Gizmo's cutting up for the suckers that's down with.
And so, you know, at the time, you know, it's like, yeah, you got a crew? Yeah, I got a crew too. Yeah, we do this, that, and the other. And we have speakers this big and amplifiers that are 800 watts and, you know, all this nonsense, right? So that's, and Giz came to the school first. And so me and Giz built up a friendship at that time. And a year later, Milk, his brother, came to the school as well.
MCMI, people call me Milk. When I'm busting up a party, I feel no guilt.
And, you know, from there, it was, you know, check out what we do. And he came and checked out what we did and da-da-da. And so at some point, his father, Nat Robinson, their father wanted to get into the music business. At the time, he was at some computer company doing computer stuff. And that's pretty much how that started. And that was still high school. I mean, that had to have been 10th or 11th grade. And the way I met Light was Eric, my partner in the Alliance, lived in Flatbush. So when I would go over to his crib to practice, he introduced me to this group called Sparkle and Dazzle. Right. It's two girls from around the way, the 90s. One was named Lisa and the other was named Lorna. So Lisa and Lorna got this cute little routine. It was cute, but So I forget which one Light was. She was either Sparkle or Dazzle. I can't remember. But the routine was just it wasn't the greatest. But, you know, I was like, yeah. You know, one day we'll hang out and you come through and all of that. So fast forward to a little later, me and Eric were going to Staten Island to work with the Audio 2 on something. This is now, and I'm fast forwarding past the Beast Within and the Flip Flop album, because we did what we call the Flip Flop EP, where Audio 2 did three songs on one side, Alliance did three songs on the other. And so this was right after that. We went to Staten Island to work on something, and Eric brought Light with him, and we ended up doing Cram to Understand You that weekend.
I used to be in love with this guy named Sam. I don't know why, cause he had the head like that of a clam. But you couldn't tell me nothing, cause Sam was number one. Cause to me, oh my gosh, he was one in a million. I should've knew the consequences right from the start, that he'd use me for my money and then break my heart. But like a fool in love, I felt
that was the first thing she did out the gate.
Did you know she had that ability? You know, like when you first, you know, from seeing her in the group to,
well,
that moment
in Sparkle and Dazzle, I didn't really see anything because it was just a halfway effort that they were giving to try to do whatever. And I've always felt that when you had the opportunity, you need to go for it. I don't care how uncomfortable you may feel or awkward, just go for it. But the next time I saw, but even at that time, I heard something in a voice that I never heard from a girl before. And I was like, damn, that's all right. But, you know, other than that, I didn't think anything of it until the next time I saw her. And then she came with this routine, which was just, you know, the Creme to Understand You routine. I was like, oh man, that's dope. And Milk put something together, and it was like, oh wow, that's crazy.
Could you do me wrong? Sing your sad song about your lover so strong. You said, wait, like you're confused. The girl is my cousin. Your brother agreed, but later said that she wasn't.
Just like a test.
Forgotten next month. We went to
what were the
Duke
sessions well, like on with Light? A lot of back and forth. Did she just kind of did you come with just the beat idea and then she comes with a song idea and you make that work? Or
yeah, that the way we used to work was we would kind of come up with an idea and then put it together. Sometimes I would create a beat first, other times she would come with a concept first and then say, okay, I think I'll put something together around that. And that's kind of how we work. And we did a lot of stuff was like that. Paper Thin was like that.
No, that's not my strategy, not the game I play. I admit I play a game, but it's not done that way. Truly, when I get involved, I give it my heart. I mean, my mama sold my body, I mean, every part. But if it doesn't work out, yo, it just doesn't. It wasn't
Stop, Look, Listen, a lot of stuff.
Like me, no trait of originality, but yo, I am not one to down another. So like I said before, just go for your sucker. I'm gonna take the time to drop a dope line.
Yeah.
You've obviously been doing this for a good amount of time, you know, and you're a producer, like we said, engineer, it seems everything. Is there a difference, a major difference when you're, let's say producing, for example, producing a female artist versus a male artist? Like, is there beats or sound you just would never use or you won't even try to use with a male artist or a female artist? Or is each case its own case?
Well, not really, because whatever I would use with a male artist, I would use with a female artist. The sound selection isn't, to me, a sound selection that I use doesn't really have a sexual orientation to it. Like I don't necessarily relate string pads to women versus men.
Right.
You know, a string pad is a string pad. A violin line is a violin line. And because when you think about it, hip hop will take a sound that exists and has a definition and we will totally flip it. Right. And that's what makes it hip hop. So for me to say, oh, I'm going to take a, you know, I'm going to take a, like, I'm going to do a record for women, and all I'm going to do is sample women, and that's what's going to let you know that it's a record for a female. Nah, we take female vocal samples and flip it all the time, and it's a totally male record, you know, and vice versa. So I always approach a hip-hop record like a hip-hop record. Doesn't matter who's on it.
I want to get back to, so After Light, the album comes out. Mm-hmm. What happens next for you?
Well, I'll tell you like this. In I'd say my heyday, when something came out, I never stopped to smell the rose of that thing coming out. I just kept going. I would go on to the next thing. So I'm working on the next thing. And then I'm hearing, oh, yeah, you know, so-and-so is popping. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's great. That's great. Like, I remember I did a record, and my cousins are down south, and they start calling me, and they're like, hey, yeah, you did a record called Dr. Soul? I'm like, yeah, how'd you hear that? They're not even playing that on the radio. Yeah, they playing it on the radio all the time down here. Blah, blah, blah. You have something to do with that? I'm like, yeah. So, I mean, I just keep going. It's, you know. And it's lost that thing that keeps you
feeling so good. Was there, like, it seems like now, just you listen to the radio now, and I'm not, this is not a critique of anything on the radio or praise of anything on the radio. Mm-hmm. But you hear it now and you kind of hear a very similar sound. So you believe like there's some sort of like formula, so to say, to make a radio hit. Was that the case back then? or has that just like kind of, you know, through trial and error, people have figured out, okay, there's a formula to make a radio hit?
Well, what happened was there wasn't a formula to make a radio hit, because initially radio didn't care about hip hop like that. The way hip hop got on the radio was there were shows, DJ shows that appeared in 1 hour slots or 2 hour slots where they would play strictly hip hop. So there was a station called HBI that had DJ teams like the Supreme Team.
It's the world's famous Supreme Team show on WHBI 105.9 FM every Tuesday from 1 till 2 o'clock.
Awesome 2 and Mr. Magic, and they would have 1 hour, 2 hour shows, and they would play hip hop. So at the time, they're playing nothing but Sugar Hill, because that was the only label that had all the rappers. And then slowly, as you know, new labels came up, they would play that stuff, but it was all underground. Underground meaning you had to wait till 1-2 a.m. in the morning to hear the show, and then you knew what was happening, and then you're playing it on your radio in the streets. But radio, regular radio, was still BLS and Kiss, and Hot 97 wasn't even around then. And so We never made records to be played on the radio. That's why records were 15 minutes long and 10 minutes long. And it was just a party groove. It's going to get played in a party, and I'm going to be popular in the neighborhood, and all of that. Fast forward to when it got to the point where you had Red Alert.
Yo, we're the Boogie Down Production crew with the TR-808D Nice, DJ Scott LaRock, and I, the Blastmaster KRS-One. We're chilling at 98.7 Kiss with our homeboy Cool DJ Red Alert. And we like the
Magic and Chuck Chill Out with a longer show. Then the song started taking on song format, and then they started trying to figure out how to make it a song versus just one long verse. And you know, so that's how it slowly grew into what it is now. I think today they've broken it down to a formula where they didn't want to veer too much to the left or the right in terms of tempo, and that's why everything sounds like a Luther Vandross love song with, you know, 808 kicks and you know, somebody mumbling something. And so, you know, that's the formula. It's like, okay, whatever.
Right.
But back then, we were just trying to catch a groove or a hook, make people dance at some point, and, you know, get the cute girl to smile at us, you know.
When it started being, like, when it started getting radio recognition, when hip-hop started getting radio recognition,
yeah,
how did that change you as artist and as a producer? I mean, did you feel like you had to adapt to that just to stay, quote unquote, relevant in the game, or
no? Any artist that you meet, when they come, when they're faced with that, they always want to change the industry versus the industry changing them. So when we first got introduced to the, hey, you know, you can't just rap for 4 minutes straight and then pass it to your man. You got to break this up into this, that, and the third. I mean, we were cool with that concept because, like I said, our group kind of styled ourselves. We wanted to be Houdini, and Houdini always had a good song format, you know, concepts and verses and bridges and all types of things going on. So it didn't so when we had to get radio ready, I didn't really have an issue with changing, you know, our format too much to make it fit. In other situations with other artists, I felt that it's like, yeah, I think I want to still try to bend the rules a little bit and get this artist to still stay in their element of kind of rawness. And so it was always a struggle. And at that time, the A&Rs didn't really know hip hop like that. We were teaching them, you know, and they were trying to front like we weren't teaching them. you know, it's like, oh yeah, we know, but y'all a bunch of househeads. Y'all don't know hip hop. So
I had this question for later in the interview, but you kind of stumbled. You talked about it a little there. When I was reading up on you, you read a lot that says your quote, production was so far ahead of the curve where producers are still catching up and catching on to his techniques. What does that mean to you when you hear that? But how are you, just for people who don't know, how were you, quote unquote, far ahead of the curve? And did you know you were far ahead of the curve?
No, I didn't know I was far ahead of the curve. And it's everything to hear that, because that's why we did it. That's why we do it, because, you know, it's about being impressive. Like, you know, so you want to do something that everybody, you feel like everybody just can't jump up and do, you know what I mean? It's like, and so I never tried to approach it like, okay, I'm going to approach it exactly like the guy before me approached it, because then you just go get the guy before me. Why even mess with me? You know what I mean? So when I hear that kind of thing, that's why I really do it. And that is also tied to why I don't have all of my information up on the internet, because I always felt that the people that dig to find the information are the ones you really want to be in contact with. See, before the internet was the way it is, and before you had Instagram and Twitter to connect directly with your fans, you never really knew who your fans were. You knew it in the abstract. You knew it in sales and popularity and when you go to a show. But even among them, you still don't know who the true fans are. The true fans are the ones who are digging for the information on the given subject. Okay, those are the ones I want to talk to. Ah, everybody else, all right now. Good to see you. Thanks for coming out. But I don't want to sit there and have a 3-hour conversation with them. You see what I'm saying? And that's why I kind of, I don't put my information up there like that. You know, even when I see information that's a little, it's like, well, nah, that record came out in 88 and somebody said it came out in 89. It's like, ah, whatever.
Right.
You know, like I don't have a Wikipedia page. You know, I go to other people's Wikipedia page that should refer to me a little more. They don't. Whatever.
I know. I was looking for you forever. Like king of, oh gosh, I keep getting the discography. I'm like, no, this is great.
Right. The important part is getting the business people to understand who you are and always know that, okay, he was part of this and da da da, and the publishing is this and that. Okay, got it. And that's it. All that other stuff is like, whatever.
Has ever been, you've worked with a lot of people, as I keep saying, has ever been that, like, kind of that one artist that you've sat down with for an album, for a track, that has, like, blown you away in terms of, like, his or her, I don't know, story capabilities, or kind of the blueprint in their mind of, like, I want to do this, this, and this, and you feeling like, all right, this is going to be good. This is going to be amazing.
Yes. Most notably, an artist named Barshaw, B-A-R, for short, B-A-R-S-H-A. And we worked with Barshaw and put him out on, we started another label called Bum Rush. And Barshaw had this kind of style that was like, oh man, he would tell a story and it would be so gritty that he'd just say the foulest things, but he just made it sound so good. It's like, oh man, that's what an MC is supposed to sound like. And it was fun doing the material. The first single I did on him was Who's the Master? And the directing debut for that video was done by Malcolm Jamal Warner.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so we did Who's the Master, and the B-side was a song called Internal Affair, which was also the name of the album. And Internal Affair was an underground hit, But not many people know that it was also the instrumental of that was also the bed music for Wendy Williams for about 4 years.
How you doing?
That music that she's playing in the background is the instrumental of Barshaw's record. Yeah. Oh man, Barshaw had he had dope stories, and you know, we just had fun. See, the key to really doing this is to have fun. I try to have fun when I sit down and start a project, and the Barshaw album was fun. This latest project I work with, this young lady named Tori Wolf. Oh man, when I first heard her, I was like, oh snap, she sounds dope. Now, mind you, I'm in semi-retirement. Like, you know, I'm like, as far as production is, it's like, yeah, I could produce, but I don't sit down and go seek it out or whatever. Right. I'm, you know, doing whatever else. But when I heard her, she reminded me vocally of what I used to hear Sinead O'Connor. Mm. And I was like, wow, that's crazy. And then she had the nerve to be able to write a song. I was like, oh snap. So what I did was I sat down and I put something together. And see, the way I like to write songs is I don't like to mail you 15 beats and you come up with something I never heard or we never talked about, and we call that a song. That's a lot of that to me is disjointed, and I can hear it. I don't know if everybody else could hear it, but I can kind of tell when I'm like, oh yeah, these people never met.
Right, right.
So I was able to sit down with her, and oh man, sitting down with her, we just came up with bangers. First one we did was a banger. The second one we did was a banger. The third one was the one that's out now.
Free.
But I might have something better for you. I'll tell you how to make that good thing last. Yeah, featuring Malcolm.
Right.
And man, I just enjoy working with her.
I want to ask you about Tori, but at first you just talked about sitting down with someone to do an album, do a song, the importance of that. You come from an era that you had to do that.
Yeah.
And now you're in an era where you don't. You can just go to your, like, I can go to your SoundCloud page, right, and find a beat. Hey, I like this beat. Or you could email me a beat and we just go back and forth. Have you had to be in that situation where you've had no choice but to work with someone via email?
Yeah. I
mean, do you remember who that or what that was like, and what you took away from that after you?
Yeah. Sometimes you just can't be there. Sometimes, first of all, I don't like to travel, so I let my passport expire. Right. So in a case like that, when the artist is in town and then is going to leave town, at some point that's going to happen. You're going to have to mail them something or email back and forth and that sort of thing. I remember early on, this was before Pro Tools and all of that. Light had to do a record and she had to go out to L.A. Matter of fact, that happened a couple of times, but she had to go out to L.A. And I didn't go with her. So I did my part here, and then she went out to L.A. to finish it off, you know, in those cases. But at some point, you know, I feel like people need to get together to actually make it really work. I don't like to work in that sort of, hey, yeah, you know, Dropbox me the blah, blah, blah. Because, you know, part of producing is, you know, the back and forth, the coaching, the coming up with a concept and mashing out a cohesive something another. Like,
right.
Other than that, it's like, yeah, we just doing that.
Yeah, engineer producer. I interviewed Rich Ahey. He works with Mastace a lot.
Okay.
We were interviewing. We were down in midtown, downtown, like Bob Power Studio.
Yeah.
And he talked about it. He has a studio set up where he's actually the artist is not behind the glass. Mm-hmm. The artist is actually like that right there. That, you know, this is your console, and the mm-hmm. artist could be right there where that phone is.
Yeah.
And what he found, a lot of artists respond positively to, because one, as the producer, you can't look at your phone because mm-hmm. the artist is there, and you know, you can't be like, whatever. Yeah.
Right.
And the artist felt like, they're watching, you know, they're paying attention to me. I could actually perform versus like what the F is going on back there.
Right.
So it's interesting how, like, when you hear people just email back and forth, you're like, well, I feel like this could be a stronger collaboration if you were just in the same room together.
I mean, oh man, it's a weird thing. Like, the technology in a lot of ways has made things better, but at the same time, it's made people, it's brought out a lot of lazy habits people have. So, like, the emailing back and forth should mean that, hey, we can really get this right.
Right.
If we just carve out 3-5 hours and go back and forth and fix everything we need to fix or whatever, this could actually turn out right. It never turns out that way. It always turns into some nonsense. Like, people will throw distractions in their own face and then be like, oh yeah. Nah, I wasn't listening. Can you do that again? what are you doing? We used to sit in a room for 10 hours.
Wow.
To communicate with the artist, I would press a button to say, hey, blah, 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 and, you know, give my advice on how to approach the next thing or what needs to be done to get it hype. Because sometimes the artist can be a dope artist, but, you know, mentally they're just not where they need to be. Or sometimes they're not sure of where to go mentally with it to approach the song right. So you give them a suggestion, they try it. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, you try something else. And that's the back and forth that needs to take place. Sometimes that gets lost in the email, in a text. It's like, I don't know how to say, you know, F you in a text so you hear what I'm saying when I say F you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? If I'm in the room or you're over there and I press the button, you're going to understand. It's going to change your mood to where it needs to be, and I'm going to get the energy that I need to hear.
So when you were working with Tori Wolf, you went out, she came here to New York, and then...
Yeah.
You said you banged out, what, 4 songs with her?
Yeah.
So how long of a process would that... I mean, what is it, like, a 4-song process? What do you think is a good amount of time for 4 songs between the producer and the artist?
Well, we didn't... See, what happened was we tried out a song, and on that song... It was such a banger, that's when we decided to do more songs. So it wasn't... We didn't do those songs like, okay, this weekend we're gonna knock out as many songs as possible. What happened was, after that song, we'd set up time to do another song, I'm not sure how long after that, a week later, 2 weeks later, whenever she came back to town, that we work on the next song. But that's kind of how that happened. So when we went to do the next song, it was about a conversation, and then it was about a conversation, an idea, sitting down in the same space while she writes to the idea, and whatever needed to be tweaked gets tweaked immediately, and boom, we start to lay it down. And that's how it happened, and that's how Free happened also at a later date.
Free features Macklemore. Was that kind of the plan going into the song, that it would have a, I'm not saying Macklemore was in your mind, but that it would have a feature, or
no? When we did Free at that time, DJ Premier was the feature, because when we finally finished it, Preem heard it and he was like, oh man, this is dope. and he heard a section where he's like, "Yo, and I got an idea for a DJ section that I want to put in there." I said, "Cool." Boom, he puts it in there. So now, at some point, they were getting in touch with Malcolm Moore to lay a verse down on something, and they sent him a few songs that we were working on at the time. Macklemore picked Free. When he heard it, he was like, "Yo, this is dope." Boom. "Yo, I want to get on this." Yeah, no problem. We're going to carve out space. Now, that one, his schedule's so hectic that it had to be an email situation.
Right.
But see, that's still different because he knows what's up. He's part of this process. It's not that goofy, this happened, da-da-da-da. Nah, it was, boom, sent it to him, da-da-da-da-da. He clear, focus, understand the concept, da-da-da-da. Emailed it back. It's like, "Oh, this is beautiful." Boom. "Let's finish the record." And that was it.
I want to go back to concepts. And so as... obviously, when you hear Macklemore's verse, you could tell if he has the concept right? Because mm-hmm. we both understand words.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand DJ scratching. I mean, in terms of like, it doesn't, you know, I mean, the whole idea, like, it speaks with, you know, you, DJ speak with their hands. Mm-hmm. So when Premier gets on a track
mm-hmm.
and does what he does, how are you ensuring that he is going to get the concept as well for whatever he's going to add to this piece of music? I mean, are you sitting down with him and telling him what's going on, or do you have that relationship with someone like Premier that you just know? I mean, obviously,
See, because the way Preem works, that's exactly how he works. Like when Preem does a scratch piece, it's specifically tailored to whatever the concept of the song is. Most times it's the hook of the song. So he mentally sits down and figures out in his mind the vast knowledge of the library of records that he knows, and he pieces together some bangers, some gems. So when he initially heard the song, that's what happened in his head. And he's like, "Yeah, I got something for that." Boom. And then he goes and sprinkles his pixie dust. And so, you know, as far as telling him what I'm looking for, whatever, when he heard it, he already knew. So
is he like one of the only DJs, producers out there that you would kind of trust to do that?
I mean, there's others that I have respect for, and see what it is again, when speaking earlier, when you asked me, did anybody was I self-taught, or did I have people around me that helped me? So once I decided to have a certain strong focus as to what I wanted to do, and I was very adamant about it and professional about it, that's when other professionals get delivered to me to mentor me in the direction I'm going. So it's a mutual respect for the process of getting it right. Getting it done.
Right.
So Premier's like that. And there's a bunch of other professional hip hop R&B producers and singers and players that I've had the honor to be in contact with that, you know, I respect what they do. So I used to micromanage, but I found that the higher you get on a certain echelon of doing this, that you don't have to micromanage those guys anymore. Those guys know exactly what needs to be done, and they do it. All you have to say is like, "Yo, this is what I need," and it's going to get done. And, you know, so.
One more track that I want to talk about, Tori Wolf, is Shadows Crawl, which is produced by Premier, mm-hmm. but remixed by you.
I did a remix.
You did a remix for that. when collaborating, I mean, just more talk about Premier, but just when collaborating with someone a producer on any track, and then you doing the remix for it, how are you ensuring that you're not, with the remix, you're not kind of losing the mission of the track yourself?
That's a good question. The mission, the mission of the track. So when I approach a remix, like in the early days when we approached a remix, it was about deconstructing the song. So because back then songs were just, they were too full. They just had too much going on, and they were active. And right. Oh, yeah, it's gonna be a great dance track. And on the hip hop side, we hear it and we're like, yeah, that's dope, but there's too much going on. We just need the drums. We want some bass, and you know, that's about it. And you know, we might have a stab here, there, some scratches, but we wasn't into all the strings and horns, and it was taking all that stuff out. So the way we used to approach, and the way I used to approach mixes, I would deconstruct the song of the pieces that were already in the song. And then later on, I would totally flip the song. I would figure out what the key of the song was, but then the music would just totally change. I'd change it into something else. That song of the Shadows Call remix, I actually did sitting at this table right here because Preem was working on a session, and Ian, his manager, was here, and they were talking about it, and somebody had they were talking about a remix of that song, and somebody had submitted a remix and all of this, and I listened to the remix. I was like, that's trash. It don't even make sense. I'm like, why would you even consider that? I was like, and I said, and you're making this harder than it really is. Mm. What you need to do. And then as I said it, I stopped. I said, hold on. And then I did it, and then I played it for him. And it was like, oh. It's like, oh, okay. Lift on some. Man, you got a wealth of joints, man. Just take, it's a remix. Just take her a cappella and let's get this popping. So I did it.
So you not only, as I said, you do a lot of things, and a lot of those things now are, you're part of Premier's Live from Headquarters team on SiriusXM.
It doesn't matter what a song sounds like. How does it feel to you when you hear it? If it gets into your soul, that means it's dope. It doesn't matter what instrument you use. That's it. That's why I play what I play.
What's good? This is Questlove of the Roots.
Oh. Grandmaster Caz.
What's your boy Big Snoop D-O-double-G? Yeah.
Yo, this your man Method Man right here.
This is Eminem. You're listening to DJ Premier Live from Headquarters.
When Premier asked you to be in radio, what were your initial thoughts? And then kind of what's the difference, or is there a difference, between collaborating with Premier in a radio setting, a radio studio, versus a studio like we're in now, record studio?
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, you listen to radio and you listen to the characters on radio in any type of show. And so when he asked, yo, I'm going to go do this thing, you know, you should come through. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Now, initially, I used to come through as the King of Chill. And, you know, that was cool. And but I still felt like I needed to develop myself as an interesting sort of character to speak every week. You know, I think I'm interesting. I don't know if other people think I'm interesting every week. So what happened was we went into some hiatus around Christmas or whatever. And so coming out of Christmas, I had come up with this whole concept of a creepy clown. So when I came to him with the idea, I said, yo, I'm going to continue to do a series with you, but I'm only – going back on this creepy clown. He looked at me like I was crazy, you know, and he asked me, did I smoke weed? I said, nah. I was like, oh, so you're just fucking crazy. Like, nah, man, creepy. And, you know, I had to explain the concept to him. And, you know, went on. It was a hit. And I've just been Creepy Clown rocking out ever since.
That answers one of the questions about Creepy Clown. Wait, why Creepy? Why Creepy Clown?
Okay, so one day my nephew-in-law is going through one of his young, you know, indecisive what to do with life sort of crisis. And I'm giving him the speech about, yo, you need to focus on something. Pick something, any widget, and focus on it and turn it into something. And it doesn't matter what it is. It could be anything. Take, for instance, a creepy clown. Now, I just made that up. And so when I said it, as I'm saying it, I'm, you know, once I said creepy clown, then I hit him with the, you come up with the widget, and then you give the widget a look, you give the widget an identity, you come up with a marketing plan around the widget, and then one day the widget exists. And that was the whole thing. So after I give him the whole speech, 3 hours later, I'm still thinking of creepy clown. I'm like, yo, creepy clown. Yeah, it could be a face and it da da da. Wait a second, creepy clown. If I spell creepy with a K, it's the same initials as KC. I'm like, and my mind just kept going, and I just created it. Oh man,
how does your how do you use radio to, or maybe you don't, but how do you use radio to kind of serve your, maybe your goal, as someone who loves rap music and loves hip hop culture? How do you use it to kind of advance that or share with the audience this love for it?
You know, Preem's format is playing new music, new quote unquote underground music. And underground music today are the artists that are out that we don't necessarily hear because mainstream radio, you know, they'll give you a certain amount of new artists, but it's not these artists, even though these artists are constantly coming out with something new, but they just don't have a large format to play it in. So that's what Preem does. And I, you know, I try to help him in any way I can. Like when I come across new music and I think it's dope, you know, I'll send it to him. I'm like, yo, I think these guys are dope. And, you know, we just try to keep that sort of thing going. And every now and then when we're talking on the radio and we might be talking about a subject about, you know, old school or whatever, you know, I sometimes got to jump in there and correct the timeline or the information. It's like, actually, it was like this. Or it was like that. And, you know, so.
That's my last question for you. Yeah. I know we've been talking for a while. Looking at your discography, it doesn't have to necessarily be a producing credit. It could just be like you were just sitting in, you know, sitting in the studio that day, right?
Uh-huh.
But is there like a moment in your discography that you were like, you're still like, oh shit, I can't believe I was a part of that. Or, oh shit, I can't believe I made that beat.
Uh-huh.
Is there that moment for you?
Oh man, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of those moments. I'll tell you a funny moment. I can't believe, remember this woman named Desiree? She was a singer. I want to be round. I want to be
Yes.
I want to be stronger. I went to one of her sessions at Sony, handcuffed to a woman.
Wait, what?
I went to her session, man, handcuffed to a woman. So at the time, the producers that she was working with, I was also working with as well. And so I was just hanging out. So they're in the session. They're like, yeah, come on through, you know, whenever. So when I get there, you know, it was a Friday, Saturday night, you know, hanging out with old girl. We're handcuffed. She had real handcuffs, and we were walking down the street handcuffed. It's like, wow, this is kind of exciting. It's mad illegal. you know, so we walk into the session handcuffed, and Desiree's real proper and, you know, very da-da-da. And I think her husband was there, and, you know, it was weird. It was almost like being handcuffed in front of the pastor. Like, she just looked at us weird. It's like, yeah, you know. Had a cup of coffee, some drinks, and was out. But fun stuff like that, you know, to get away with stuff like that is kind of.
He's a composer, producer, engineer, MC, radio host. He's the king of chill. I want to thank you so much for joining me in the library, Tim Renico. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Since 13, everybody knows the king was the first to bring a devastating rap to the massive crowd. The heckling boos or hissing aloud. Cause when the king is on the mic, it's a sure enough treat. And I can tell that you approve by the tap of your feet, or by the bopping of your head, moving of your torso. Yo, I'm the king of chillin', you just ought to know. There's no doubt in the mind, I'm the one to provide a kickin' live party while the others have died. Cause rhymes like this allow me to exist at the top of the list of things you can't resist. So you know the story and you've heard the facts, so plain as day and clear as color Kodak. I'm the king of chill, top notch on the rack. And if you don't agree to that, get off that crack. So K-Swift, huh, without further delay, come on in, get on the mic and hope. Your hands cold clapping while my voice is cold rapping. Everybody's jamming, only suckers cold snapping. Do it to simplicity, only done in ecstasy. Fellas want the fresh, while the girlies want the best of me. I don't mean to say that I'm the best or the greatest. Only when we screw up, they come and try to raid it. Alliance in a pact, in a group or solo. I sport a session while they sport polo. Girls, I wanna clock them, I try to knock them. The boyfriends try to riff, but my 45 stops them. Ayo, skill, I'm about to jet. Get on the mic, ready, set. The beat is tough, so get your ears tuned in, cause you will never hear a DJ rhyme like this again. It's a rhyme seldom heard, I rarely won this one. Only say it to the DJs who will call my sons. Like a son, you got to learn to abide and obey, cause I'm giving all the orders, nothing for you to say. Hand me your 12, take your mix and shred it piece by piece, cause your DJ days are over, your career will see. I'm super nice, top notch, and there ain't no question. And when I burn DJs, I make them lose their complexion. I leave you in an awesome state of total rejection. I never make mistakes on what they call perfection. Outstanding, outspoken, always incredible. Attempt to get live and it will be regrettable. Now, let me explain the game and its players. The DJ cutting up and the dope rhyme sayers. One, yes indeed. One and remaining of a dying breed. Yo, I'm living proof of Darwin's theory. Survival of the fittest overcomes the weary. Two, K-Swift on the case from the get-go. Ladies get excited when my voice is on tempo. A master, a genius, a wish fulfiller. The K may be cool, but it stands for killer. Three, just so you know we spoke before. But the girlies wanna hear the brother speak some more. And he will. Yo, DJ Skill, do you have finesse? In scratching terms, that means yes. Just a wink of an eye, that's all it takes. It's the sound it makes when skill is.